So since I started teaching, starting being a Buddhist teacher about 1990, I think this is the fourth presidential election that I teach the night before, Monday night before. And this one, there seems to be a lot more anxiety around this one than the other ones that I've been for. And I'm rather really impressed by the degree of anxiety that seems to be gripped a lot of people. And in the way it's at least, you know, publicized over and over again is that half of the American population are going to be disappointed. They're terribly disappointed, seemingly. And the other half, I guess, will be happy. And it seems kind of sad that it's set up that way. That, you know, in some ways I don't like competitive sports when you have two teams and one team wins, one team loses. It's so sad. The team has to lose. When I run with my son, he likes to race me. And so sometimes we race in all kinds of ways, and I let him win, I win. But I also like to arrange it so that we tie. And then I express great happiness. Look at that. We managed to tie. We don't want that tomorrow, right? I'm also impressed. One of the things that's been very impressive about this current election for me is the degree of which people I know have participated, been actively involved. And it seems like there's a huge network on both parties. All three parties, I guess. I don't know how many parties are up, but at least three, right? Two in all the states. And but how many people are out there, both parties, participating in the whole democratic process with getting people out to vote and calling and a whole range of things. And it's quite something to see. I mean, that's kind of my understanding of how the country was founded, was the idea of participatory democracy. And the idea that people's votes count. Here in California, it doesn't count that much, apparently. In terms of the presidential election, they say, but you know, some places it counts a lot. And so I have one friend who flew to Ohio to help there, another one who went to Nevada. People going different places. And so it's kind of, you know, it's kind of you know, nice in some ways that people feel that it counts so much, that their participation counts and it's important, and they feel that feel so motivated to go do something. And I mean, I underscore, maybe you all know this, there's a tremendous amount of anxiety. The degree of fear that's gripped this country is just astounding. It's kind of like the kind of fear that, or fear and distress and anger and many of the different, some of the feelings that were felt after 9/11. And some people I know, I've had people talk to me who've, you know, actually one person left the country already. He left 6 months ago. And he said, I'm not going to be around for this. It's too difficult for me. And all kinds of very strong feelings that people have. So it's kind of amazing, an amazing thing that it should happen this way. So I mostly just wanted to name it, so people just as name. Sometimes it's useful to name things, name what's happening. And what I'd like to do this evening is to teach you about, offer you a teaching, a list that the Buddha had, of the 10 qualities of a Raja, Raja Dhamma. And Raja is a king, kind of Indian kind of king, kind of person, monarch. But it can be for any political leader. I have participated very, very little in any kind of American political scene and any activity. One of the most, for me, one of the biggest things I ever did was I was invited last year, a year ago, to a dinner with for Denis Kucinich. And it was a friend of mine who had a house, and I'd been to the house, so I said, come to dinner at my house with Denis Kucinich, he's running for president. I said, well, that's interesting. That's interesting. I had dinner with my friend. I've had dinner at her table, you know, and her dinner table's not that big. I said, oh, sure. If it's dinner at your table, I'll come. I'd probably go to any presidential candidate. So it was interesting, so I was invited. And then a week before, she said, oh, when you come, can you please do the prayer or the invocation or the blessing at the beginning? I said, oh, well, sure. I'm kind of designated minister in my circles sometimes, so. Sure, I'll do that. And then I showed up there, and she had rented all these big tents and picnic tables and catering, and there was like this huge event, you know, like, I don't know, 60 people there. So I was kind of lost in the crowd. It wasn't that there was going to be this intimate dinner. But I was supposed to do this blessing, you know, so what I was supposed to do. So what I did was I evoked these 10 qualities of the Raja Dhamma, I call them the 10 qualities of a political leader, as a kind of invocation, as the beginning. But what I said was that, as an introduction to the invocation, I said that in America, that America is a democracy and everybody votes, that in a sense, everybody in America is supposed to be a political leader. And that these are qualities that everybody is supposed to carry with them. Everybody has responsibility in this country for what happens because we vote and participate in all kinds of ways. And in that participation, everybody, the qualities or attitudes or virtues that we, all Americans need to have, not just our political leaders. So with that as the introduction, then I evoke these 10 qualities for the people who are there. And then I got an email or some kind of contact saying, oh, Dennis likes that list a lot. Will you send it to him? So I thought, oh, that's kind of nice that maybe it'll make its way in. So that was my foray into American politics. Today's talk is not meant to be political, but I think the Buddha was relatively shy. Also, I don't know if shy is the right word, but you don't see in the records that he had much to do with politics, and probably you couldn't back in his time because most of the places he hung out in had very powerful monarchs. Monarchs who were going around conquering other areas. And mostly you kind of try to stay out of trouble, because if you get in trouble with a monarch and kind of say, well, I don't think I like monarchy, the consequences were quite serious. So the Buddha, I think, was, stayed kind of quiet about his political views. But what he did do, instead of talking about political theory or politics that way, what he did was he offered the attitudes, virtues, how we are. And you see that over and over again in the history of Buddhism, that or the teachings of the Buddha, that how we are sometimes is more important than what we are. And so the focus on the how. So in terms of a political theory, there's, at least in ancient India, there was no real political theory as kind of what kind of political state you should have, democracy or communism or socialism or, anything, monarch or whatever. But rather the emphasis was, the Buddhist teaching was how people should carry themselves, how leaders should be. How people should be, the virtues, the attitudes, the choices people would make. So I like to think that rather than some idea of theory of a perfect state, Buddhism has more the idea of perfect housekeeping. So rather than thinking that you finally get your house just right, clean it enough and then you have to clean it ever more. And the whole focus of everybody is to get this perfectly, Martha Stewart house. And then we can relax. But that's kind of silly, right? Because basically housekeeping never stops. And if you have kids, you never catch up. You're just always going, cleaning, an amazing amount of laundry. And so how you are becomes really important. If you're trying to get to some final goal, that you're in trouble. But if you're focusing more on how, just doing the housework and how you are while you do it, it can be very rewarding. and actually be quite profound experience if you focus on the how you are, as opposed to focusing on the goal. And so the same thing with maybe with the you know, the Buddha's approach to politics was the focus was more not on the end goal in a sense, but more on how we are, how we carry ourselves about. So as an introduction to these ideas, this idea of these 10 qualities of political people, a little bit about political theory that you kind of pull out of the Buddha's teachings. And that is that the Buddha distinguished, as other people have distinguished, between two kinds of power. Between power that comes down from the top and power that comes up from the bottom. So top down is where you have some authority figure. You have a god, or you have a king, or you have a dictator, or you have something. And there's someone who holds the power. And that power is exercised among the people. And the people live in a state of coercion. They do what they're told to do, and there's no questioning of it. The other form of power, of government, is that which is dependent on, which is top, bottom up, which is government of consent rather than coercion. And here people have power. Whoever is leading the government, can have a lot of power, but it depends on the cooperation and goodwill of the people who consent for it to be there. And to some degree, a democracy is meant to be that way, that it's a government of consent. So every 4 years, America votes for a new president, and it's, you know, the person who has a position, it's been granted to that person for 4 years at a time. It comes from the people, in a sense, and that's where they kind of going up. Now, sometimes the top-down approach, when it's really strong, when it's held in power by military force, for example, or fear, it becomes kind of monolithic and self-perpetuating. It can be actually quite stable and strong sometimes. In the kind of bottom-up approach, which is the approach of consent, it's sometimes quite fragile because it really depends on many people cooperating, working together. Cooperation may or may not continue. You know, it's kind of, things change. And so people, the kind of democracy is kind of a certainly messy thing. It's kind of a fragile phenomena. And I think it's always kind of sloppy because it requires this level of consent and cooperation, which is always changing. So power by obedience versus power by consent. And so the Buddha was encouraged or saw encourage power by consent. And the way you see it is in terms of mythology. In ancient time of the Buddha, one myth of political power was myths that come from the top down. That people had certain power, it was hereditary. The Brahmins, you know, had certain authority in society. And that was kind of divine. It was kind of the universe, how the universe was made. It was divinely sanctioned. And it was passed down from father to son, down through the generations. Or a kingship was somehow divine. It was, you know, people, maybe sometimes, some places people were, you know, children of a god. That's how they got to be king. The Buddha offered a different myth for how political leaders get born originally. And his mythology, he had a whole story, ancient story he made up. He talked about. And that was people become leaders of a society by the consent of the people. They're elected. And the first king, the first, back in mythological times, got that position because out of the consent, out of the election, out of the appointment of the people who were around. So that's what the Buddha kind of then championed, was this idea that power by consent. And you see, the only place he had any political, Buddha had political power to formulate a society, form a society, was in his monastic order. And the monastic order originally was basically a democracy, where every monk, as soon as you become ordained, had one vote. And it didn't matter if you had been ordained for 50 years or one day, everybody had an equal vote within that society. There was kind of in some ways, it was a very horizontal society, the society of monks. However, there was also a vertical dimension that some monks had greater spiritual understanding and realization. And so somehow that had to be taken into account. But that didn't affect their vote. The most realized monk and the least realized monk both had one vote. So there's a kind of interplay then of kind of a spiritual hierarchy, a vertical dimension of authority perhaps, but then a horizontal approach where everyone participated in the decisions in the monastery and in the community. And then there were complicated rules about voting in the ancient tradition, the Buddhist tradition. One of them was that if you were in the monastery, you had to vote. There was no absentee, otherwise absent. Everybody had to vote. And if you were really sick, then they'd come and get your vote or they'd carry you to the voting place. Mm-hmm. And then there was a provision for absentee ballots, apparently. Vote by proxy. Now, in this ancient tradition of the Buddha, in his teachings, the primary function of a political leader was to redistribute the wealth. Isn't that interesting? You know, to evenly distribute the wealth in some way. And the reason for the rationale for that is that poverty breeds crime and discontent and strife in society. And so you want to do whatever you can to avoid having poverty in your community. And so there were ancient myths. Again, Buddha told these myths of what would happen when there was poverty and how that was undermined the health of a community. And then there was a teaching of the four bases of political service, the four kind of four approaches of, you know, of what a political leader is supposed to be interested in. One, again, is distribution of wealth to the needy. There was no idea that everybody had to be equal, you know, equal, but there had to be no poverty. And then the second is the person had to practice kind speech. And the third, wise conduct, ethical conduct. And the fourth, the person needs to have a feeling for the common good. And I like this a lot, the feeling of the common good. And I think this is where I think something really seems off to me in America right now, in that it seems to me, and I don't know much about politics, and even in America I feel, but it seems the lines are drawn so tightly, and it seems like people almost feel like if our party gets elected, we have a right to do certain things. We have a mandate. The word is mandate, right? We have a mandate to do certain things. And so if I have 51% of the vote, then screw you, is a little bit the sense that I get sometimes the way people talk or the way people act. And but if you have interest in the common good, then I think that it probably wouldn't become so partisan. It would be something you're interested in what everybody thinks and how to work together. So I'll give you these lists of 10. As I give them to you, don't just measure your political leaders by their absence and presence of these things. We can certainly encourage these qualities in our leaders. But maybe more important is that you find these in yourself, these qualities. And because in America, everybody is a political leader of sorts, political participant. But more importantly, I think that how we carry ourselves is as important as what we want, more important than what we want, how we want our leaders to carry themselves. That the level of distress and fear and anger and hostility that I pick up in society these days, for me, is an indication that we need to look at our anger and our fear and our hostility, not let it get the upper hand, and let the hostility and the anger and the fear run how we see the situation, see what we do and how we respond. So what can we call upon in ourselves? Can we call upon these qualities as an alternative to fear, anger, hostility, and these things? I read an article recently about a massive study that the the International Committee of the Red Cross is doing, where they went around, they were going around all kinds of places around the globe where there have been wars recently, and interviewing people interviewing kind of common, ordinary people about their experiences in wars. And as they listened to all these terrible stories, what kind of surfaced to the top, and what really was interesting and what these interviews were pointing to, was the stories of compassion and altruistic compassion that were found in these different war settings, and how there were people, you know, Muslims who helped Christians, or, you know, people crossed enemy lines in order to help each other, or people, ordinary people, so-called ordinary people, doing extraordinary things and saying, well, wouldn't you do that for me if the time came for that? Situations where even offering someone a glass of water was a great act of compassion, maybe quite dangerous. So they became interested in all these movements of compassion, and were really impressed that in these great times of stress, that compassion still seemed to be expressed by many people. And so they're continuing a long-term study to try to understand what's behind these acts of compassion during war. And tentatively, they come up with four kind of, I don't know if reason's the right word, but four conditions that seem to be need to be in place in order for people to express compassion in times of crisis like this. And first was they call self-efficacy. A person has the ability to do something. So if a person has the ability to do something, that's one condition that their compassion can flow forth. And maybe it seems kind of maybe too obvious, but it's not so obvious, I think, that unless we see where the avenues of action are, then the compassion won't come. And the person can think, well, where is my compassion? Where is the compassion? Well, maybe the people had no ability to do anything. But people who had something to do, they acted. There was one story of a Palestinian ambulance driver who said, if there was an Israeli soldier who was wounded and he had just killed my brother, I would still take him to the hospital because that's what I can do. That's my role. That's my job. That's what I can help. And so people who feel like they have something to do, so even offering a glass of water or, you know, many different things that people can do, that was one of the conditions for the flow of compassion. The second was a sense of affiliation with the people. And they talked about how there's all these different ways in which people feel affiliation. There's affiliation with your family and your tribe and your community and your ethnicity and all that. But the people who somehow had a kind of more wider, relaxed, and broad sense of affiliation with others, so that they saw they had an affiliation with other people and something in common with them, even if they were the so-called enemy, tended to have their compassion flow much more easily. So a sense of brotherhood and sisterhood, perhaps. The third condition for flow of compassion in times of crisis is a sense of reciprocity. Reciprocity. And this was the idea that if I was in the same situation as you are, you would do this for me. I remember once up in San Francisco, outside some of the projects up there, I was standing there, and this car careened to a stop in the middle of the intersection. And these big, tough guys in the project, you know, they're really big, look like football players. I mean, they're big to me, you know, I'm 6'1", and they were like big and strong. And at first this woman kind of crawled herself out of the car, and these two big guys ran after her. And she was yelling, and they were after her, and it didn't look very good. So I just went, I had to do something. So I went up there and stood between them and her and said, I would say, you know, leave her alone. And they take, you know, two steps towards me, and I take two steps away. And they'd come forward, and, you know, I was trying to talk with them and have some exchange, but I didn't know what to do. And they were big. And you know, there wasn't really, the conversation wasn't going anywhere useful, I felt. And then this other guy came walking up, and he said to them, you know, if you were in the same situation as her, I hope, you know, he said, if I was in the same situation as her, I hope that you would stop and check out and find out what was going on for me. And that kind of changed the whole thing. They relaxed, she relaxed, everybody relaxed, and then the situation was just became fine after that. But somehow using a sense of reciprocity, a sense of we're all in it together and we can all kind of take turns in different situations, that was one of the conditions that these researchers found was helped the flow of compassion. We'll all be sick someday, so let's take care of the people who are sick around us. We're all going to die someday. And then the fourth was... in order to regain their moral integrity. In order to regain their moral integrity. Now, this is not supposed to be a comprehensive, you know, condition. This is was a tentative conclusions that these researchers come to so far. They found it really fascinating. But these are the four things they identified so far as responsible for the birth of compassion in times of great wars and suffering. So, people in war sometimes will lose their moral integrity. And he talked about people who killed and did all kinds of things, terrible things. And then in order to regain their moral integrity, be able to feel good about themselves, to do some acts of compassion. So even in times of war, people can call forth within themselves great nobility, great beauty. And I think that, you know, as you listen to these 10 qualities of a leader that the Buddha talked about, maybe you can evoke these qualities in yourself. And then over these next days and weeks and months and or years until we decide who's going to be the next president, you can kind of call on these 10 qualities. So the first quality is of a leader is generosity, to be generous. The second is to be ethical. And in Buddhism, that means live by the five precepts, at least, the ethical life. The third is to practice self-sacrifice. And that's a very curious thing for the Buddha to say, because in the Buddhist tradition, there's very little language that specifically says focus on self-sacrifice. There's a lot about renunciation and different things. But the idea of self-sacrifice seems a little bit foreign to most of the way the Buddha taught. But for political leaders, well, for rajas, for kings, it seemed like a good teaching. You know, some self-sacrifice here is pretty good. Some of the kings in the time of the Buddha were clearly self-indulgent. So self-sacrifice. The fourth is honesty. The Buddhist Peace Fellowship is thinking of coming here, they've asked us if they could borrow our center here to put on a series of talks, maybe in the spring, the series would be titled Truth in the Public Sphere. And I thought that was a nice idea. Truth in the Public Sphere. So what does that mean? The practice of truth-telling. The fifth is gentleness, to be gentle, not harsh. The sixth is self-control. That's pretty obvious for a leader. The seventh is practice of non-anger, of not acting or from anger. And the eighth is a practice of non-violence, or the dedication to non-violence. And the ninth is patience and tolerance. And the tenth is non-deviation from the Dharma. And the Dharma in ancient India was understood much more broadly than just like the Buddha's teachings or Buddhist practice. The Dharma was kind of like the norm or the law or the truth, the harmonious pattern of how nature works, reality works. So not to deviate from these spiritual truths or truth of how things are. So if we see powers originating outside of ourselves, then these 10 qualities of a political leader are irrelevant to us as individuals. But if we see that the power resides in ourselves as individuals, as a society of individuals, then I believe these 10 qualities are important for each of us. So I'll go through them again so you guys can, maybe they can kind of sink in a little bit. So generosity, ethics, self-sacrifice, gentleness, self-control, non-anger, non-violence, patience and tolerance, non-deviation from the Dharma, and honesty. So evoking these 10 qualities, then it becomes hopefully clear the value of a practice, a life of practice, spiritual practice, or a life of inner cultivation. That it's not easy to call forth and really rely on these qualities, to have these qualities really strongly in us. And so what spiritual traditions will say is that you can cultivate these, you can develop these qualities. Don't leave it to chance that they're there, or don't just kind of let, you know, but rather these things can be cultivated and developed. And so a spiritual life or practice life, meditation, the practice of ethics, the practice of generosity, the practice of self-control, the practice of patience, that actually kind of develop these qualities of us. And the assumption I have is that most people in society have at least a few of these 10 qualities underdeveloped in them. And probably some of you have them underdeveloped. And so, can they be developed and become a resource, become a strength? Because one of the conditions for compassion was self-efficacy, was some sense of having some ability to act and work in the world. And so if you have these as strengths, they become background resources we carry into situations. We can fall back on them and use them in situations that be quite difficult and challenging for us. I hope that none of you over the next days and weeks find yourself in any kind of situation, political situation, or that is challenging and difficult. But if you find yourself in such a situation, I hope that you will reflect on these 10 qualities and see if the best in you can come out. And if the best in each of us can come out, then perhaps it will ripple out into the wider society and make a difference there would be a very different difference than if we respond to causes and conditions and situations with our anger, our hostility, and our fear. And you come from a place of strength by having these 10 qualities firmly under your belt. So those are my thoughts about American politics. Our center is supposed to be a nonpartisan place. And so that's about as close to that I dare go. So we have about 10 minutes. Does anybody have any comments or questions or reservations? Please.
By not anger, do you mean not expressing anger to other people? I assume it's fine when anger is the emotion is okay. You don't want to suppress that in a person, right? But not anger, do you mean more in terms of not expressing it rampantly around you?
Right, as a minimum. I think that I think anger can create tremendous, when we act on it, can create a tremendous amount of damage. And so one of the virtues in Buddhism is forbearance. And forbearance usually is when you hold your anger in check. But holding your anger in check is not the same thing as repression. And that's it's a very important distinction. And certainly when there's anger, it's very important not to repress it, but to actually see it clearly and acknowledge it and in some ways kind of hold it. But there's most anger that people have is born out of something that is most anger that people have is not really necessary. It's not a necessary response to the situation. There are some times when anger maybe seems necessary, but the function of anger is to be motivating. I think the best function of anger is to motivate people to do something. And hopefully they use the anger then to motivate them to do good. But and that's one of the primary justification that people have given me why anger is good, is it motivates them to get things done. But I found it's very sad, because I think there are as powerful, or maybe more powerful, sources of motivation to do the same work. I think compassion can be extremely motivating, and you can get, you know, it can motivate and give people strength and power to go and face difficulties or face challenges just as much as anger can. And so if we're relying on anger to get motivated, I feel it's a little bit sad if that's the only thing a person knows. If they can learn to work with their anger and get to the roots of it, understand the depths of it, so that maybe it doesn't get triggered in the first place, then there's a greater opportunity to let other motivating forces arise within us, and then we can act in the world from those. So non-anger, you know, means a lot. So you either don't act on it or find out how to not to... don't act on it if you have it, but if you do, but if you can, see if you can uproot some of the unhealthy forms of anger that might arise. Is that okay as an answer? Maybe you'll think about it.
In the sutras, is there anything about the need to let go of tribal beliefs? Because what I see going on to me seems to be not... The schism in our country is really about belief, cultivating beliefs and hanging on to them. It seems in human nature. I remember growing up, I would ask questions like, what do we believe about death? You know, what does my tribe, Jewish tribe, believe about happens when we die? What do we, you know, what do we believe about,
right,
you know, this and that? And making very strong... It was natural to make very strong kind of positions about that, and observing in the world that people seem to die more and create more wars and disharmony over belief systems than anything else. So it seems to me in the Dharmic healing of that, that there really needs to be some sort of letting go or greater understanding of, to go beyond the belief system.
So Mark says that he wants to know if there's some way in the teachings in Buddhism that helps people overcome group affiliation, group identity that can be quite strong, tribal. He used the word tribal. And because certainly in the name of religion there's been a lot of violence in the world, people identified very strongly, but also different ethnicities, and some way of going beyond the close identification with a group, so we can kind of take in other people. The example of the Buddha, who was willing to go and meet anybody, he traveled around India, he met the poor, he met the rich, he met, you know, all people in all conditions. There, his door was open for everybody, and he didn't seem to discriminate. But who he both talked to, but also who he included in the monastic order. And the monastic order was kind of this society where ethnic and economic and all kinds of different divisions broke down within this monastic community. And so they all lived together. So there's an example of a community that's managed to do that.
Wasn't there still male female?
There was that.
I hear my wife's voice saying something about
that. No? It's not until really in America that we've... that you see Buddhist monastic communities where men and women live together as equals. And so that's something that was probably culturally quite impossible until recently, to have that. I mean, the Buddha did create a monastic order for nuns, and but they were somewhat separate from the monastic community of monks. And So that division remained. I like to think of Buddhism as being as a religion or a spiritual tradition, as being one that is self-destructing. That people's you know, the whole idea of identity in Buddhism is one that personal identity is one that is questioned by Buddhist practice. And you look at any kind of clinging and attachment to a sense of self or this is who I am in some essential, you know, central way. And so to hold on to some identity, you know, I am an American, I am a Buddhist, or I am whatever. It's a source of suffering that to hold on tight to that. And so even the idea of being a Buddhist, I am a Buddhist, Buddhist practice kind of undermines the ability to hold on to that tightly. Isn't that great? The religion itself destructs. And so the Buddha, you know, so then, you know, I shouldn't even talk about the Buddha anymore. But one of the classic examples of or stories around this kind of teaching is that of the raft. The Buddha said that if a man comes to a river and there's a raft that takes him across the river, and then the path for the other side of the river continues into the jungle, he'd be foolish to pick up that raft and then put it on his shoulders and then carry it through the jungle path. Once the raft has done its trick, you leave it behind. And so, you know, once Buddhism has done the trick for you, you just leave it behind and go on with your life. So the idea is not to hold on to Buddhism, you know, or keep it as a tight identity.